Well done.
Good evening. Appoint State Affairs Committee to order at 5:40 with a fresh quorum. Will the secretary please call the roll?
Representative Wu.
Here.
Representative Kopp. Representative Ledoux.
Here.
Representative Birch.
Here.
Representative Johnson. Representative Tuck. Representative Jones. Representative Knopf. Chair Price Tompkins.
Here. And we have a Judiciary Committee running at the exact same time, so Representative Ledoux will be excused as she runs back and forth. Good cross-training for her triathlons between
it's
the two committees.
Popular.
I know. I'm also on that committee, but I have decided not to be
there.
Really? Yeah.
We're here, then.
And Representative Tuck is excused, as previously noted, and Representative Johnson and or Knopf may join us. We have two items on this evening's agenda, House Bill 173 from Representative Josephson, a first hearing, as well as House Bill 183 from Representative Tallarico. As noted earlier today, with House Bill 183, we are looking to put a committee substitute on the record and allow that to circulate with committee members. This time I'd like to call Representative Josephson forward to present House Bill 173 as well as staff Megan Rowe. Representative Josephson, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Andy Josephson. I represent District 17, which is the University Medical Center in Anchorage. And with me is Megan Rowe, who is my House Resources staffer and an attorney and capable person. And, Mr. Chairman, as you know, I generally am quite hands-on with my legislation, and I'm known to talk a bit. But you're going to be very surprised because in this single instance, that isn't going to happen. Instead, I'm going to just talk to you broadly about why I filed this and then turn it over to Ms. Rowe. I filed this because I'm a believer in science, and I think the state, I think it was Justice Brandeis that famously said state legislatures are great laboratories of democracy, and that's going to be especially true now because we have there's some belief, I think, within the new administration and the new director of the EPA that climate change is not real. But we know here in Alaska that because we see it firsthand that it seems to be, and that most scientists think that it is so. And so originally I had filed in the previous legislature a bill to recreate essentially the Governor Palin sub-cabinet commission and then charge it with recommending legislation. This is a little bit more sophisticated, I think. It creates a commission. It's patterned after the concept of involving coastal and local communities to populate that commission. And then it creates a surcharge to create, through using SPAR, a SPAR surcharge, to create an actual office within the governor's office, which would then do all manner of things related to climate change, including work on mitigation and grant access, and sort of bring an all-of-the-above approach to the problem of climate change. And with that, I can answer any questions, but I've hardly said enough to raise any. But there is one.
The Brevity Caucus co-chairs may be offering you an invitation of membership. Representative Wall.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned a SPAR charge. That's a spill. Maybe you could spell that out for those that don't know exactly what a SPAR and SPAR fee structure, which you mentioned. Or SPAR funding or something like that.
Well, we have, through the chair, we have an expert on the SPAR account in the room. And SPAR stands for Spill Prevention and Response. And it dates back to, I'm going to say, no earlier than 1989. I actually was an aide here that session as a young man, which I once was. And it is part of the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez.
Follow up?
Thank you. So, Yeah, so I'm familiar with what SPAR is, and it's funding through oil per barrel and per gallon sold of fuel, I believe. So when you say SPAR, this commission, is it funded on the same? How is it funded?
I'm really going to pass the baton at this point.
Okay.
Who is the Lifeline representative, Joseph?
I'm going to start with Ms. Rowe.
So through the chair, my name is Megan Rowe. I'm an aide to Representative Josephson. The commission, the bill does two things. It creates the commission, and then it creates a fund for the commission. The reason that we're bringing up SPAR is that in the drafting of our bill, we sought to mirror the how SPAR is funded. So how SPAR is funded, in part, is through a 1 cent surcharge per barrel of oil. And so what we wanted to do is take the same 1 cent surcharge per barrel of oil and fund the Climate Change Response Fund. In our original drafting, we thought we could just go into the SPAR fund, double it, and then take 50%. But that is pretty complex. And then in dealing with in working with the Department of Law and our legal drafters, we have drafted an amendment to change the funding mechanism. The way that SPAR will still come into play is that, by comparison, if SPAR is taking 1 cent per barrel, and then the Climate Change Response Fund will take 1 cent per barrel, they'll be funded at the same level. And so we have someone from DEC here, but we've also heard from our own Ledge Finance that SPAR is funded on average at $1.6 million per year from that 1 cent.
Follow-up.
1 cent per barrel of oil that goes through the pipeline is what's paid out by the oil company to fund SPAR. Is mm-hmm. that correct? I thought there was a 0.098 or 0.099 cent per gallon of fuel sold. Am I mistaken?
So through the chair, there is a motor fuel tax, but there's a surcharge per barrel of oil. And there's two, actually. There's one that is the spill prevention and response, and then one is this, there's one for prevention, there's one for response. And so I believe the one for prevention is 4 cents, and the one for response is 4 cents, or vice versa.
And also, mm-hmm. to fully delve into SPAR, there may be other resources in the room you can consult.
Yeah.
At okay. least on a high level.
I guess I think, through the chair, yeah, I guess what I'm trying to find out, I mean, I'm familiar with SPAR. I thought it was mm-hmm. 4 or 5 cents per barrel plus 1 cent per gallon sold that we passed last year.
Through the chair, SPAR has under other funding sources, so perhaps that.
But let me finish my yes. question, which was, regardless of how SPAR is funded, how exactly would this be funded, I guess is what I want to know, other than say it's just like SPAR.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, it is. So it would be funded by a 1 cent surcharge per barrel of oil. And then that would create the Climate Change Response Fund. Another facet of this bill, though, is that what we're hoping is one of their biggest duties is that they assist groups in getting grant funding. And so there's ways, I think, that they can get financing for themselves, for these groups, that they'll be able to have independent funding.
And a clarifying question for me, the them and what you just said is the Climate Change Commission would help groups get funding?
Yes, exactly. Okay. So we realize that there's a gap through the chair. We realize that there's a gap in Alaska in services to help organizations like nonprofits, tribal governments, even business entities tap into the vast amount of climate change financing that there is, including grants and other types of public and private funding. And so one of the roles of the commission will be to help secure that type of funding, and then to help fund the climate change, the commission itself, we installed this 1 cent surcharge.
Follow
Sorry,
up.
Not to beat a dead horse, but thank you, Mr. Chair. So the 1 cent gets assessed to the TAPS consort, the who pays the 1 cent? The consortium of oil companies that uses TAPS?
Through the chair, I believe it is the producers. We could also talk, we have someone from DEC here that can, but I believe it's the producers.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Representative Birch, a question?
Well, I'm stunned. It's like another day, another tax on the oil industry.
That's what this room is so accustomed to.
I know. It's like, you know, hammer it home again. Okay, so once again, when, through the chair, when did global warming become climate change? And I know it happened sometime, but how and why did that happen? This is climate change, and I seem to remember there's a big stir about global warming.
Yeah.
So maybe if somebody could explain that.
Yeah, through the chair. We have someone available from the University of Alaska on their Arctic Center that deals in climate change. I believe it's just because they called it global warming at one point because scientists thought that the Earth was warming, and now they realize that it's actually shifting temperatures. And so we do have a slide on this that in the United States, if you can see that in the United States, there's various levels of warming. And so in some places it's getting colder, in some places it's getting warmer. And Alaska seems to be affected by warming more so than any other state in the United States.
Okay. Well,
permission to dialogue, yes, Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Permission granted, Representative Wolt, to dialogue with Representative Birch.
Especially Representative Birch. If I may offer, it's just my take. I believe it started off people saying global warming, which in fact is going on. So I think the average temperature overall is going up, and with that, there's a lot of climate change, you know, hurricanes and droughts and floods, and so there's a lot of other climate besides just temperature going up, and there may even be snowstorms or what have you. So people say, wow, there's a snowstorm. That doesn't look like global warming, but it's all part and parcel of climate change due to warming. Mm-hmm. That's my take on it.
Yeah, sure. And I accept that.
Yeah.
By the way, what I will say though is I am troubled by, in all seriousness, you know, a further tax. Mm-hmm. Just you know, another penny here, another penny there. I am concerned about you know, layering up another tax again, even a penny a barrel. Which I remember years ago, there was one holdout. If I might, Mr. Chairman, there was one holdout in Wiseman, an old miner. And he was the last person standing before they built the pipeline, and I remember he held out for, you know, I want to say millions of dollars. And I was thinking somebody should have coached him. He should have just got a penny a barrel going across his land, and he would have been far, far better off. So a penny a barrel adds up quickly. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you very much. Any other questions, Representative Wall?
Continue the presentation.
And through the chair, the $1.6 million, that would fund like the operating expenses, and then also that money, the commission would have the power, or all the revenues generated, which are estimated to be about $1.6 million. The commission would have the power to divvy those out, but also it could use that money as seed money to access some of this other climate financing that is available. And so I think that in Alaska, regardless of our feelings about climate change, that there's about $400 billion spent annually on climate finance. And we have one testifier that will talk about that. Other states are competing for this money, and Alaska is not. We're missing out on opportunities to get financing that would especially help rural areas, but also could help improve the economy of Alaska in terms of like green technology. So that's what we're hoping that money would be primarily used for, is to gain access to other financing.
One question I have, not to the revenue side of the bill, but more to the commission and sort of the function that commission serves, is what lessons were learned from the Palin era iteration of the cabinet level climate change position or commission, how well that worked, and how this is differentiated from that, if at all.
Mm-hmm. So I think one of the biggest products of the Palin era group was that they produced a report, but I think that they were defunded, and so they stopped operating at some point, and then they didn't really have a funding mechanism, and they also didn't. I think that they were more of a policy group. They were more of a monitoring group, and so what we sought. The changes that we sought to include in this new iteration of the bill is to, because Representative Josephson filed this last year, and that was based on that administrative order. And what's changed is that we want to make sure that rural communities have a seat at the table and that we're helping them get access to funding. versus just being a policy and monitoring group.
And I apologize for not knowing this offhand, but independent of the commission doling out funds from this 1 cent per barrel tax, would the commission itself have an operating budget to operate independently?
So in working with the Office of the Governor and creating the fiscal note, the commission would determine how to distribute program funds. I believe that the governor's operating budget wouldn't dictate how their funds were spent, but they would more so independently divvy them out.
Or maybe put another way, would the commission have dedicated staff?
Yes. So in the bill, we have an executive director, and then that person can hire staff. That might require an appropriation by the legislature, though. But they could also use the funds from the SPAR, the surcharge.
Okay, thank you. And I'm seeing that now. Other questions, Representative Wohl, Representative Birch, for response. We also have invited testimony. Two folks in particular to bring forward.
And Mr. Chair, if Ms. Rowe could just
absolutely
power through the PowerPoint. That would be it.
Absolutely.
I just have a few slides. So one of them is just the four purposes of the bill, which we kind of have gone over. We want it to be an umbrella group so they can coordinate a statewide strategy. We've heard from different organizations that a lot of things are happening piecemeal, and so if we could get some coordination happening, like with the university and nonprofits. We've also, number two, to give rural communities an active role. We structured in the current draft, we structured the commission to have six individuals that from the administration, so the department commissioners from the Department of Environmental Conservation and Natural Resources. But then also we have, in the current iteration, nine regional members. We copy-pasted that language from the Coastal Commission, so we've actually excluded Fairbanks. And Fairbanks is the most, that interior region is the most affected by climate change. So we have an amendment, I think you guys have a copy of that. We have an amendment to restructure the commission for fewer members, so we can represent the interior. We want to make sure that we give rural people a seat at the table. The third purpose is to help them secure funding, climate finance, grants, aid, low-cost debt. And then the fourth was to create the fund. The next slide. Let's see. This is just showing that Alaska is being impacted more by climate change than other states. You guys have a copy of this. This one is to show the regions in Alaska that are more impacted than other regions. At the outset, I was thinking that it would be perhaps the area of like Nome and Kotzebue, those islands, maybe the southeast, but it turns out that according to this study, the infrastructure in the interior is the most affected. And I think it's because there's so much infrastructure there and the melting of the permafrost. And I think it will have billions of dollars of impact unless Alaska works to fix that infrastructure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you say infrastructure, are you mostly referring to roads and that kind of thing? I mean, is that, I don't know what other infrastructure we have. Buildings and houses, but.
Yeah, roads, exactly? Railroad, the pipeline, through the chair, electrical systems, sewer systems, any type of public or private infrastructure. The melting of the permafrost, I think, affects that.
So, mostly permafrost is moving the ground, which. Mm-hmm. And some of the structures and causes a lot of damage, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And then we've included a paper. It's by Melvin et al. It's in your packets. That's where I took this graph from. But it goes in depth in the cost per region and what type of costs there will be. I'm kind of summarizing it as public and private infrastructure. All right. And then that slide. We also included a packet about climate finance. And we have someone available to testify about it that has more of a national perspective that has worked in Alaska. The $392 billion, a lot of that is public funding, and a lot of that goes to developing countries. So Alaska is not going to have access to $392 billion, but it's just an example of a lot of money is being spent on climate finance. And I think Alaska is not competitive in that way. And so a part of the commission would be to help them to help for the commission to help nonprofits and tribal governments to get access to some of that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
As mentioned, there is invited testimony that I wanted to be sure to get to today. And two folks, I apologize in advance on any mispronunciations. Michael Tubman in Washington, D.C., and then also Hayo Eichert.
Hayo Eichert.
So perhaps we could start with Michael Tubman with the Center for Climate Change and Energy Solutions. Mr. Tubman, if you could put yourself on the record and present any testimony on House Bill 173.
Sure. Thank you. And thank you, everyone on the committee, for the opportunity to speak with you today. I'm Michael Tubman. I'm originally from South Anchorage, and I'm currently the Director of Outreach at C2ES. C2ES is an independent, nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank. Our mission is to advance strong policy and action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, promote clean energy, and strengthen resilience to climate impacts. A key objective is a national market-based program to reduce emissions cost-effectively, and we believe a sound climate strategy is essential to ensuring a strong, sustainable economy. Our work is informed by our Business Environmental Leadership Council, or BELC, a group of 32 major companies that work with C2ES on climate change and energy risks, challenges, and solutions. BELC companies include BP, Shell, BHP Billiton, Rio Tinto, GE, a number of utilities, automakers, and other large industrials. The views I'm expressing, however, are those of C2ES alone. My presentation this evening will focus on the need for safe climate action plans and our climate change strategies and the opportunities they can help unlock. So the need to confront climate change is increasingly clear, and I commend you for taking these steps to pursue a stronger strategy. In Alaska, the U.S. Global Change Research Program expect significant climate-related challenges. The impacts for the state through this century include increased annual precipitation, but with greater evaporation leading to lower water availability and snowpack, greater risk from wildfire, glacial retreats that may affect hydropower and fishery resources, and a number of other impacts. So coordinated planning between public and private sectors can overcome these challenges, and this is the goal of a climate change strategy. At the same time, many states view policies to address climate change as an economic opportunity. These states are positioning themselves as leaders in new markets related to climate action, producing and selling clean energy, developing new resilience technologies, and attracting new business. These goods and services are increasingly in demand in a global market moving towards a carbon-constrained future. Economic issues are just one motivator for state policies that address climate change. Policies to prepare for extreme weather events, improve air quality, reduce traffic congestion, and develop domestic clean energy supplies can all have climate benefits and are worthy endeavors in their own right. Alaskans are not alone in your interest to develop climate strategy. 34 states have completed a climate action plan or are in the process of revising or developing one, and many are now focused on the implementation of their existing plans. The origins and structure of strategies is varied as the states. Some of them start with executive orders, while others begin with legislation. One of the keys to a successful climate change strategy is getting input and buy-in from stakeholders. Climate change mitigation and resilience will affect numerous sectors of the economy, including energy, hunting and fishing, agriculture, transportation, health and water, among others. It's important to include diverse perspectives when creating climate change strategies to ensure mutual understanding and an effective strategy. But the private sector also has a stake in climate change strategies. As they demonstrate, states and localities are serious about ensuring the energy and infrastructure needs of businesses. Over the last 18 years, C2ES has worked with big business to find practical, economically efficient approaches to climate change. In a specific example, last year in Anchorage, we convened about 50 business leaders, city, state, federal, and tribal officials, nonprofit organizations, and other experts to share their experiences addressing climate change impacts and enhancing resilience. These stakeholders helped assess the climate resilience of Anchorage on a number of indicators critical for communities and businesses. Now, as the state moves from strategies to action, the federal government has tools and resources that can help. Two important examples of federal tools are the Climate Data Initiative and the Climate Resilience Toolkit. The Climate Data Initiative is part of data.gov and offers open source access to information for communities and decision makers. It includes data and resources related to coastal flooding, food resilience, water, ecosystem vulnerability, human health, energy infrastructure, and transportation. The Climate Resilience Toolkit is an interactive government resource that helps users and communities explore climate threats, assess their vulnerability and risks, investigate options, prioritize them, and then take actions to become more resilient. Both the Climate Data Initiative and the Climate Resilience Toolkit have a special focus on the Arctic, which includes 250 Arctic-related data sets and more than 40 maps, tools, and other resources designed to support climate resilience efforts in Alaska. Now, some federal programs provide direct resources that can be used to implement a strategy. The Resilience AmeriCorps program helps low-income communities become more resilient by providing volunteers to local governments. Anchorage has actually taken advantage of this opportunity. Other competitive federal grants for infrastructure take resilience into consideration, such as the Transportation Investment Generating Economic Recovery Grants, or TIGER grants, from the Department of Transportation. Those provide federal funds to improve the transportation infrastructure, generate economic recovery, and enhance resilience. At the DOE, the Department of Energy, the Partnership for Energy Sector Climate Resilience is an initiative to help enhance U.S. energy security by improving the resilience of energy infrastructure to extreme weather and climate change impacts. DOE works directly with utilities to help them prepare for extreme weather and climate change, which can save money and lives. EPA has numerous programs that provide resources and assistance for climate adaptation in environmental and health infrastructure and systems. The use of these federal funds is amplified by having climate change strategies that can demonstrate the long-term planning of the state. Importantly, in the federal budget process, appropriations process, Alaska senators have the ability to bolster these programs and make sure they are providing adequate resources to fulfill Alaska's resilience needs as they are further identified. Planning for climate change also makes business sense. Many businesses recognize the threats extreme weather and climate change pose to their supply chain, operations, and infrastructure. They already make risk and emergency management plans, along with drills and training exercises for employees. This experience in risk management can be coordinated with city and state agencies to build and maintain resilience. Alaska is home to many global companies, including the oil majors, which have experience in disaster response planning. In addition, these companies and others may have access to more detailed data and long-term scenario planning that could bolster public resilience efforts with the right climate strategy. Companies also seek to work with governments to reduce risk. They consider the resilience of a community as a factor in determining where to locate their business. For example, a business may be more likely to move to a location where there is extensive coastal flood protection versus an area that is less prepared for coastal risks. By increasing the ability for communities to plan for, respond to, and recover from extreme weather risks, Alaska can remain competitive in the economic marketplace. And my final point is that planning for climate change just makes fiscal sense. Infrastructure should be built to last, and it should provide economic benefits over the long term. Resilience planning is just another part of making sure government money is spent wisely. On a national level, for instance, EPA found that from now through 2100, resilience measures could reduce estimated damages to coastal property from sea level rise and storm surge from $5 trillion to $810 billion. Making Alaska resilient to other climate change damage would save money over the long term. And according to a 2005 National Institute of Building Sciences study, a dollar spent on disaster mitigation saves $4 in future costs associated with recovery and allows the federal treasury to redirect an average of $3.55 from disaster relief costs and tax losses to communities and other outcomes. By developing a climate change strategy that helps avoid losses and speed recovery, Alaska is being a responsible steward of its resources. Again, I commend you for your efforts to develop a climate change strategy and look forward to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Tubman. Any questions? And would also like to move on to Hayo Aiken with the International Arctic Research Center in Fairbanks, the other invited testifier today. If you can put yourself on the record and present your testimony, we would be grateful.
Thank you. This is Hayo Aiken. I'm director of the International Arctic Research Center at UAF. We conduct a range of studies in collaboration with various stakeholders in the state, ranging from tribal government, boroughs, industry, and others on changing environments, responses to changing environments. We're also working on trying to better understand how the Arctic as a whole functions and do a lot of that in collaboration with international partners. Today, I just wanted to thank you for the chance to briefly talk to you and just give you more pragmatic perspective on the on House Bill 173. I think one of the representatives earlier today brought up this question, well, what was the outcome of Governor Palin's sub-cabinet on climate change? And from our perspective, from the university's perspective, we value those types of activities because they help us produce better products that are relevant for the state. So one of the outcomes from that sub-cabinet was that the access to various commissioners and other practitioners within the state who had very specific information needs led to the production of a number of data sets, both on the present state of weather and climate and projections over the next decades, that was much more focused and much more responsive to information needs at the community level. And, so for example, we now have one researcher working with a Nome Eskimo community, a tribal organization, to help them deal with some of the challenges that they're seeing in the coastal environment over in Nome. So I see this type of commission as a forum or as an interface to help improve the information flow and the type of information that comes from the university and from other entities that can provide relevant data to the state. So in that context, I would say that this bill is prudent. It's a good, well thought out, effective response to some of the changes that we're seeing in the environment. And again, it helps to remind ourselves that the big challenge in Alaska is that we not only are seeing very, very significant changes in some of the measures that you've already heard about, whether it's the changes in precipitation, the amount of snowfall or rain, air temperature. But the big challenge we have is that a lot of Alaska is very much determined by the presence of snow and ice in various forms. So permafrost, thawing permafrost is a big challenge. The changes in the sea ice cover that we're seeing around the state. And those are challenges that the federal agencies themselves are not necessarily always well equipped to deal with. And if you know a bit more about the history of sort of the coastal revetment and trying to address coastal retreat and coastal flooding in some of the western Alaska communities, you might have heard that the Army Corps of Engineers definitely has struggled and continues to struggle with effective solutions in keeping those communities safe. And so that's where I see the value of a commission like this, is to create a space where practitioners and policymakers from the state side can engage with other experts and representatives of the community to figure out what is it that we actually need to do and what type of information do we need. I just want to give you two examples of what that might look like. I want to be respectful of your time. I know you have a lot on your docket. Last week, at the International Research Center hosted a workshop with about 80 practitioners and researchers focused on wildfire management, wildfire response. As you may be aware, a sort of a decent fire or average fire season in Alaska, fire fighting, fire response bills run into the tens of millions of dollars. If we have larger seasons, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. The frequency intensity of wildfires is increasing, is projected to increase further. And at the same time, funds at the federal level to address those challenges are not projected to increase. And the state finds itself in a situation that we may actually have to pick up some of the tab of that. This workshop was a great example where with a lot of practitioners looking at what do new, more modern approaches, what can they provide in the context of fire management, for example, using some of the new satellite platforms that we have available. And so there was a number of people who were reviewing good responses and ways to reduce the cost of firefighting down the line, both in terms of this season, next few seasons, on timescale of years or further out through directed programs over timescales of decades. And again, as I understand from the state, there was only one person able to attend with some of the limits on travel. So the role of both the university commission like this would be to help ensure that there's good connection connections made and that the state down the line can then actually apply for funding at the federal level that will allow us to be more prudent in the way we manage wildfire risks. That's one example. The other example.
And Mr. Aiken, I might stop you right there. I have a clarifying question on that example. And then I think we might move on to the next bill also. So I do sort of want to conclude consideration here, especially with limited membership. But what I think I heard you just describing in that one example is that there would be you would see value in this commission existing even outside the 1 cent per barrel tax and the funds that would be dispersed upon collection of that tax. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah, that's correct.
Thank you. Are there any questions, Representative Wool, Representative Birch? Mr. Aiken? And any concluding comments, Representative Josephson?
No, other than I know you have a second bill. There is a gentleman here from the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium who, Mr. Black, who offered some interesting commentary on in a previous committee, and given that he was in town, I thought he might want to share something on this bill as well.
Sure, absolutely. Mr. Black, if you'd like to offer a few words, we'd be grateful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mike Black. I'm the Director for Infrastructure Development at Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium, the Division of Environmental Health and Engineering. Our primary job is to build sanitation systems and clinics in rural Alaska. And Representative Josephson was present earlier today when I was making a presentation to the Committee on Economic Development, and that was Dean Westlake's, Representative Westlake's committee. There I was able to do a presentation or a slide presentation, if you will, of some of the infrastructure damage that we currently are seeing. Everything from the standpoint of pipes that are settling in relation to homes to permafrost failure on some of the foundations and how we're trying to deal with that. So I can say that we have a real issue with infrastructure and with the warming environment, especially in areas where permafrost is at close to the temperature for 32 degrees, as well as we are seeing changes in water chemistry and precipitation rates. That obviously affects our ability as source water for rural communities. And I would say that as ANTHC has a Center for Climate and Health, we would certainly support the state taking a very coordinated role in helping bring together organizations such as ours around the table to talk about strategies for infrastructure and keeping infrastructure functioning, as well as what types of infrastructure are going to be important going forward in relation to the warming environment. The other thing I might be able to offer to you, as I was a member of the Immediate Action Work Group under Governor Palin, that was a group that was formed by the sub-cabinet for climate change. I will say that at that time, it allowed the state to have a clear focus and help coordinate what has now become a number of organizations involved with climate change, both within the state and obviously around the United States and internationally. The state of Alaska at that time really was taking a leadership role in trying to bring together attention to the issues that were important to the state and also coordinating a lot of the funding, or at least recommending coordination of the funding to the federal government. I thought that was a very useful role.
Thank you, Mr. Black. Seeing no questions, appreciate your testimony.
Thank you very much.
With that, I'd like to hold this bill for further consideration and call forward Representative Tallarico and Ms. Morris for House Bill 183, Permanent Fund Dividend Land Sale Legislation. Representative Tallarico, Ms. Morris, if you could put yourself on the record, perhaps speak briefly to the bill, and as I understand it, the goal here is mostly sort of get this on the record, adopt a CS, and sort of allow the process to continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dave Tallarico. I'm the representative for House District 6, which I normally describe as the eastern half of Alaska. But I'll just briefly go through this description here, Mr. Chairman, for you. Basically, I'll blast through the sponsor statement. The state of Alaska has thousands of acres of good quality land that produces no revenue. Less than 5% of the land in the state is privately owned, and increasing this percentage creates future opportunities for Alaskans and local governments to seek tax bases. House Bill 183 will create a process that allows for these opportunities to happen. This bill requires the Department of Natural Resources to create land auctions for acres of state land in regions where public services exist or can be extended with reasonable economy, or where development of a viable economic base could be established. Any adult that is eligible for a permanent fund dividend can apply for a land auction for parcels of land. The winner of the auction can pay for the parcel with their current and future PFDs until the fair market value is paid off. The bill creates a fair and equitable method where the state can offer quality land to Alaskans in exchange for their PFD. This bill will allow the state to receive an additional source of revenue and allow individual Alaskans to obtain quality land to invest in and increase economic activity throughout the state. Though HB 183 will not solve Alaska's budget problems, it can be one small step to help with a multi-billion dollar deficit. And that's kind of it in a nutshell, Mr. Chair. The one thing that I would say is what this requires, I think, is probably a little thinking out of the box. This is a little more like, rather than what we've got established right now to get land into private hands, this is a different program. So sometimes that thinking out of the box can be a bit difficult because it's kind of a change.
Thank you, Representative Tallarico, and for running us through that on a high level. And I believe we have a CS here, version J, is that right, that we're looking to
adopt? That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And I believe motions can pass with a majority of members present even if we're below a quorum, but I'm actually not entirely sure on that, so I'm going to take a quick at ease.
Okay.
CS for House Bill 183, version J, is a working document.
So moved.
Is there an objection? Hearing none, seeing none, CS for House Bill 183, work draft 30-LS0437/J, is adopted as the working document. That concludes our business today. And thank you very much, Representative Calrico, Ms. Morris,
thank
for
you.
Being here. And at 6:23, we are adjourned.
All right.